morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Washington Governor Jay Inslee and Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced that the state is suing Monsanto over pollution from PCBs. And we expect rain in the winter here on the North Coast. John Ryan reports that climate change may bring heavier and more intense rainstorms in the future. This is The Bridge for the week of December 15th. Researchers at Washington State University in Spokane have analyzed well over 100 police deadly force encounters captured on dash cam videos or observed in simulators. That academic research has now turned in a counter-bias training program. Correspondent dropped in on the first police department to try it out here in Astoria.
Professor Lois James and colleagues have published a series of attention-getting papers on the dynamics of deadly police encounters, including racial factors.
We have two kind of major findings from our research in the lab. One is that officers, when you hook them up neurophysiologically and also when you test them using implicit bias tests, we find that they tend to quite strongly associate African-American suspects with threat, with increased levels of threat.
The other finding runs almost the opposite.
When we test them in the simulator, they tend to be a bit more hesitant to shoot African-American suspects versus white or Hispanic suspects, for example.
She and her co-authors say the caution most likely comes from officers wanting to avoid the public backlash when a minority suspect gets shot. And they don't think officers are just trying to be PC because they're being observed in a simulator. This year, James and her husband Steve decided to take the research a step further, which is how Lois found herself leading a training session for frontline officers from the Astoria and Warrenton, Oregon police departments.
I am one of those researchers who really believes that if you're not going to take your research and try and make what it is that you're studying better, you really don't have any business doing it. This one, we're going to mix and match a little bit. This one is a domestic disturbance.
On this afternoon, the Jameses run a small group of officers through 24 realistic scenarios, also including traffic stops, a robbery, and suspicious person calls. The officers take turns standing in front of a portable movie screen. They're armed with a pistol modified to shoot a laser pulse.
Let go of the lady! Sir, come out here!
The simulator screen shows the officers' point of view as white, black, and Hispanic actors, roughly life-size, play suspects, victims, and bystanders. The police department let me sit in on two scenarios and debriefs. In both simulations, the officer has mere seconds to size up the scene before one of the actors pulls a gun. A moment of hesitation and the officer would have been pretend shot instead of the suspect. But out on the streets, hesitation is just what Warrenton officer Jim Pierce says he's seeing more of. Pierce participated in the training.
There may be some slower reaction time, but I think that's been brought on to us over the last couple of years by all of the media presentation of law enforcement shootings around the country.
Unfortunately, researcher James says there's no reliable national data set on deadly force interactions with sufficient detail to prove or disprove Pierce's perception that officers in real life are getting killed because they're hesitating more. The goal of this counter-bias training is to get officers to look past skin color, gender, or a person's clothing choices and concentrate on danger cues, things such as body language, hand positions, or furtive movements toward a possible weapon.
People give certain body languages when they are getting ready to attack another individual or a police officer, and this helps bring out those body languages, setting aside anything else, race, religion, sex, anything else.
These coastal Oregon officers are the first paying customers to experience the portable simulator training program developed by the Washington State University researchers. Astoria Police Chief Brad Johnston says no particular incident prompted him to schedule the training. Rather, the national conversation about policing and justice, in his words, was on his mind. I'm Tom Bonsi in Astoria, Oregon.
Oregon state officials will ease up on testing requirements for marijuana immediately after business insiders warned that new rules would cause a drop in state tax revenues, an increase in black market sales, and layoffs in the industry. The Oregon Health Authority says its temporary rules take effect immediately and would provide relief for the industry while maintaining the public health's protection. The authority, which is responsible for adopting testing standards for marijuana products for public safety, said it is cutting three process validation tests to one control study, allowing a processor to combine samples into one composite sample, removing alcohol-based solvents from testing requirements, and allowing samples from multiple batches to be combined for the purpose of testing for THC, if batches are the same strain. Bo Whitney is an economist and marijuana businessman. He said in a study published last week that more stringent rules imposed by the health authority in October, as mandated by the legislature, resulted in products taking 2 to 3 weeks to be completely tested in the state's few certified labs, with the product often failing. He noted a drop of supplies of cannabis products in both the medical and recreational markets as there was a bottleneck at the labs. His report said black market activities would consequently increase to a projected $187.5 million per year. He predicted Oregon tax revenues would decrease by at least $10 million in the fourth quarter, and over a fifth of 72 respondents to his business survey indicated that they were going out of business. The new temporary rules are a good first step, according to Whitney, but added that he needed to analyze them more. He expressed doubts they would relieve the bottleneck at the lab, citing a huge backlog of test samples to process. He tried to buy a gun. Those are terrifying words to survivors of domestic violence. Typically, a survivor would never know if their abuser tried to buy a gun and was denied after a background check. But now a Washington state lawmaker and a domestic violence survivor wants to change that. Olympia correspondent has more.
Paula, we've agreed just to use her first name, has a permanent protection order against a former longtime boyfriend.
He was extremely scary.
Paula asked the court to protect her from him back in 1997. In a court filing, she said he had beaten her and her son and threatened to kill her and himself. Please, she wrote, make this stop. Even though Paula left that relationship nearly 20 years ago, she says,
you're always looking over your shoulder.
So she says it was like a punch to the stomach when we told her that records show her ex-boyfriend tried to buy a gun in March of 2015. That purchase was blocked after he failed a background check because of the protection order against him.
It just puts me on a heightened, like, level red alert.
Paula's ex-boyfriend is one of hundreds of people who tried to buy a gun in Pierce County, Washington last year, but were blocked. That's according to records obtained by King 5. FBI records show that background checks prevent around 4,000 firearms purchases each year in Washington state. It's a state and federal crime to lie and try to buy a gun. But our investigation has found that in Washington, police rarely, if ever, go after failed buyers. Paula says, at the least, there should be a system in place to alert someone like her when the person they have a protection order against tries to buy a gun.
Victims like me, who have tried so hard to make my life safe, my children's life safe, and I don't even get a courtesy call.
One person who agrees that needs to change is Democratic State Representative Drew Hansen.
This is no longer just my abuser's out walking around. It's my abuser has taken active steps to make him or herself more dangerous, probably to me.
Now, there's already an alert system in place in Washington for protection order petitioners. That system lets them know when the protective order has been served, and it reminds them when it's about to expire. Hansen plans to introduce legislation in January that would allow survivors to also be notified if the person they're protected from tries to buy a gun.
Maybe I just want to know so I can take a different route to work than usual. Maybe I stay at, you know, my family member's house for a week. Maybe I purchase my own firearm and take some self-defense training.
Hansen also wants frontline police officers to get an alert if, say, they stop a car and the driver just tried and failed to buy a gun. And he wants local police agencies to report up to the state the number of failed local background checks and information on any follow-up arrests and prosecutions. Hansen says he's been in touch with King County Sheriff John Urquhart, who recently told King 5 he doesn't have the resources to go after failed gun buyers.
What police officer that's now doing a job do I bring in to handle those cases? Homicide detective? No. Patrol officer? No. Me? No.
In Washington, local police agencies conduct the background checks for pistol purchases. Urquhart would like to see the Washington State Patrol take over that job, similar to how it works in Oregon. That's something Representative Hansen says he's open to considering. As for Paula, she says just a few years ago she escaped another abusive relationship. She feels like it's important to tell her story, but she was also very afraid to do this interview.
Because I can guarantee I will go to my grave fearing both of them.
She says these days she does carry a gun to protect herself. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
This week, Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden, Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, and Congressman Peter DeFazio announced that the Columbia River Restoration Act has passed in the House and the Senate as part of the Water Resources Development Act. The legislation will now be sent to the President's desk to be signed into law. The legislation would authorize the Environmental Protection Agency to establish a voluntary competitive Columbia Basin Grants Program for projects that assist in eliminating or reducing pollution, cleaning up contaminated sites, improving water quality, monitoring the basin, and promoting citizen engagement. Toxins are present throughout the Columbia Basin and are harmful to humans, fish, and wildlife. These contaminants make their way into fish tissue and can be dangerous to humans if consumed. Some of these toxins are known to cause cancer and have been linked with neurological, developmental, and reproductive problems, including birth defects and learning disabilities. The Columbia River is the largest river in the Pacific Northwest and the only large aquatic ecosystem in the United States that currently receives no dedicated funding to clean up and monitor toxic chemicals. It is 1,243 miles long, and its drainage basin extends to 7 states. Approximately 8 million people inhabit the basin, including members of several tribal nations and angling groups who frequently fish in its waters. Historically, the Columbia and its tributaries have constituted the largest salmon-producing river system in the world, with annual returns peaking at 16 million fish. The Columbia River Restoration Act is supported by a diverse group of stakeholders, including the Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, Pacific Northwest Waterway Association, and Salmon Safe. Oregon officials plan to open the commercial crab season December 18th for a portion of the coast that runs from Cape Blanco to the Oregon-California border. Officials say tests have shown low biotoxin results on the southern end of the state. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Agriculture say the recreational bay and ocean crab fishery from Tillamook Head South to Cape Lookout opens on Saturday. All recreational harvests from Tillamook Head North to and including the Columbia River remain open. Dungeness crabbing from Cape Lookout to Cape Blanco remain closed due to elevated levels of domoic acid. Other areas along the section of the Oregon coast will remain closed to crabbing due to high acidic levels. And the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission last week voted to extend by 1 year a reform policy that would ban gill netting on the main stem of the Columbia River. The extension of the transition period runs through 2017, giving commissioners some breathing room to refine the policy, which was meant to help endangered salmon and steelhead. The Fish and Wildlife Commission has been reviewing whether to rebalance the Columbia River reform policy to allow limited use of gill nets on the river's main stem rather than phase the practice out entirely. Oregon and Washington State agreed to eliminate gill netting on the main stem for over 4 years, encouraging commercial fishermen to use alternative gear or off-channel areas and increase opportunities for sport fishing. Commercial fishermen have fought the policy change since 2012 as a potentially devastating financial blow, as well as the end of a way of life for generations who have worked the river. Commissioners did not have confidence that Oregon could refine the reform policy by the end of January, given several uncertainties. The vote to extend the transition period was 5-2. The Fish and Wildlife Commission will discuss the reform policy again at a January meeting and could adopt rules and a revised timeline for implementation. In the weeks before the meeting, Oregon will also consult with Washington on potential changes. In other environmental news, Washington State is suing agrochemical giant Monsanto over pollution from PCBs. The chemicals, polychlorinated biphenyls, were used in many industrial and commercial applications, including paint, coolant, sealants, and hydraulic fluids. PCB contamination impairs rivers, lakes, and bays around the world. The state is seeking damages and cleanup costs associated with PCBs, chemicals Monsanto has produced for decades. Ruby DeLuna has more.
PCBs have been used in most everyday items like paint and electrical equipment, but they're also found everywhere, in the soil, rivers, and wild fish. Studies have found the chemicals don't break down easily, and they tend to accumulate in animal tissue. Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson says for decades there was only one commercial manufacturer of PCBs, Monsanto. Ferguson says the company knew the chemicals were toxic even before Congress banned its production in the late 70s.
Monsanto produced these dangerous chemicals despite knowing about their dangers. They knew. They concealed that information from the public. Monsanto focused on reaping profits at the expense of our environment and the health of our people.
Ferguson estimates Monsanto's responsibility to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. He expects the legal fight will be long and complex, similar to the state's legal challenge against Big Tobacco. Ferguson says this lawsuit is more than just seeking damages and cleanup costs.
The identity of our state is in large measure the natural beauty of this great state and the wonderful natural resources that we have. And we take our responsibility seriously to protect those resources and that natural beauty.
To date, there are 8 West Coast cities with pending lawsuits against Monsanto. Ferguson says Washington is the first state to sue the company. I'm Ruby DeLuna reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. Winter time is rainy time in the Pacific Northwest. No surprise there. But correspondent John Ryan tells us the region may need to get used to more intense and heavier rains in the future.
Climate change will bring rain in more intense bursts across most of the country. That's according to a new study from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. The extreme rainfall would come in the summer in much of the country. Here we'd get it mostly in the winter. The storms known as a Pineapple Express would carry more moisture our way from the tropical Pacific. Lead author Andy Prine says the Northwest can expect the wettest storms to arrive 4 times more frequently.
The Pacific Northwest is really in a hot spot. You have much higher frequency increases than in the rest of the country, at least in wintertime.
Wintertime is when heavy rains help turn hillsides into mudslides. Extreme downpours can also cause pollution by overwhelming sewage systems. Stormwater runoff is one of the biggest sources of pollution into Puget Sound, but toxicologist John Stark with Washington State University says the amount of rain matters less than the amount of motor oil and other gunk left on the pavement.
Increasing rainfall might not have as big of an effect as an increase in the number of people moving into the area and driving more vehicles, because it's really the volume of traffic.
Reducing that volume of traffic would cut down on the gunk going into Puget Sound and the carbon dioxide going up in the sky. Scientists say it will take deep cuts in the world's carbon dioxide emissions to avoid the worst impacts of a changing climate. The study appears in the journal Nature Climate Change. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
Members of the Washington House and Senate have passed a law that will return a 9,000-year-old set of human remains to Northwest tribes. The bill is called the Federal Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nations Act. Here's more from correspondent Anna King.
If the act passes and is signed into law, it would be a long-awaited celebration for several Northwest tribes. Kennewick Man, or the Ancient One, has been held at the Burke Museum in Seattle for nearly two decades. The tribes want to rebury the bones based on their religious beliefs and rights under a law called NAGPRA. That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The tribes fought for the remains for a decade with a group of scientists who wanted to study Kennewick Man. Now it looks likely that Kennewick Man's story will have its final chapter.
The Kennewick Man remains were found along the banks of the Columbia River in July of 1996 by two students. The return of the ancient skeleton will allow the tribes to rebury him in the manner their people have followed since time immemorial. The U.S. Department of Interior will consult with Northwest tribes this winter on how best to modernize laws that regulate business on tribal lands. Interior made the announcement on the Swinomish Reservation in western Washington. Correspondent Emily Schwing was there.
Swinomish Tribal Chairman Brian Clannisby says current laws that give the federal government broad authority over business and trade on Indian lands hinder economic development.
And can you imagine what would happen if Seattle went over to Spokane to implement a tax to pay for their roads and schools and infrastructure?
He says that's exactly what's happening in Indian Country, where local businesses and sovereign governments are being taxed at the state and federal level. It's something he hopes can change. Clannisby, who also serves as the president of the National Congress of American Indians, says he doesn't agree with a requirement that businesses on reservations must be licensed. He says he's optimistic the incoming Trump administration will support changes to further tribal sovereignty. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
The Indian Trader statutes were last updated in 1981. The Department of the Interior will take comment on proposed revisions through next April. In a press release, the DOI also says they will seek tribal expertise and guidance as changes to federal regulations go forward under a new administration. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. December 29th, we're building the bridge to 2017. Do you have music that inspires you? Music that you'll be listening to this next year to give you courage and help you keep or make those New Year's resolutions? Send them to The Bridge at News 1, NEWS, and the numeral 1. Tell us some of your thoughts about the new year. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.